Hello and welcome to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. I'm Naomi Fowler. Coming up later.
Moneyland is a concept. It's actually a very powerful one, trying to explain how the sort of transnational elite that are running so many countries has essentially broken free of any kind of democratic control.
We talked to journalist Oliver Buller about his book just out, Moneyland, Why Thieves and Crooks Now Rule the World and How to Take It Back. But first, here's a quick Tax Justice News roundup for this month. Among other banking scandals, the boss of Denmark's biggest bank, Danske Bank, has resigned over 200 billion euros of what's called questionable money, which flowed through its Estonian branch over several years from non-resident customers. It was so dodgy looking that even the Russian central bank issued a warning through Danish regulators about the bank's activities. The Dutch bank ING has been fined $900 million for failing to prevent money laundering. Even the EU Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker has called for greater anti-money laundering enforcement powers for the European Central Bank, along with lots of pressure from regulators across the European Union. In Andorra, charges have been brought by a judge against 9 people from Andorra, 5 from Spain, and 14 Venezuelans, including former ministers and public officials, in connection with the $2 billion plundering of a Venezuelan state-owned oil firm. None of the Venezuelans indicted in the case showed up to receive the court's notice. For most of them, their whereabouts are unknown. And just as so many Venezuelans are fleeing their country because of severe food and medicine shortages, a video has just gone viral showing their president, President Maduro, dining on steak and smoking a cigar at a high-class restaurant in Istanbul, Turkey. And finally, not all intimidation of journalists by the powerful wins through. The country of Azerbaijan sued French investigative journalists over a documentary where they called them a ferocious dictatorship back in 2015. But the Versailles Appeals Court has ruled that no nation state, ferocious dictatorship or otherwise, can sue for defamation. There's your quick news roundup. Now we're going to talk to John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network for his take on this month. Okay, John, so this month is 10 years after the famous collapse of Lehman Brothers and the 2008 financial crash. Pretty much everybody does agree there's going to be another one pretty soon. But in 2008, really, there wasn't a very comprehensive alternative ideology in place to the sort of dominant narrative that we've heard ever since, that governments have maxed out their credit cards and the medicine now has to be austerity and a steady reduction in people's quality of life in order to fix things. And it hasn't fixed anything, has it?
In a word, no. That moment 10 years ago was a systemic failure of epic proportions. The bank directors failed in their duties, so did the auditors, so did the credit rating agencies, so did the regulators, so did the financial journalists. And it's worth refreshing our memory that so did the vast majority of neoliberal economists who were clueless about the risks and assumed, like Alan Greenspan of the Federal Reserve, that financial markets were self-correcting. And they were wrong. But there were some people, and I'd like to, in particular to mention Susan Strange, who was flagging this up in the late 1990s, that all these credit default swaps and derivatives were hiding risks and inevitably the whole thing was going to come very, very badly undone. So the idea that no one had seen it coming and that there were economists who didn't know about this is wrong. So the question is, what's happened in the intervening years? Now, first, the government stepped in to bail out the bankers and the failed banks rebuilt their balance sheets, but they didn't change their ways. Quite the contrary. They went straight back to boosting real estate bubbles. They switched their activities in some cases to private equity businesses and shadow banks sitting offshore, largely to avoid taxes and avoid regulation. In some cases, they merged into even bigger banks, which makes the problem of the too big to fail banks even worse now than 10 years ago. What they didn't do is invest in the real productive economy. Let me give you an example of what I mean by this failure to invest in the real economy. The latest figures for investment in the UK show that while 62% of all lending in 2017 went to financial intermediaries and to insurance, which, by the way, is largely banks lending to each other, and 15% of total lending went into real estate, only 4% went into manufacturing, and less than 4% went into the energy, water, transport, communications and other vital infrastructure sectors, of what's called the country's foundational economy. That is the economic base on which all wealth is created. And the prospects for future real recovery are very, very weak indeed. Now, the second big story coming out of the financial crisis 10 years ago was that despite all the banking frauds, the market rigging, the financial product mis-selling, the money laundering, the assisting with tax evasion, and so on, the cops weren't called in. Very few bankers have gone to jail. And a clear message has come out that top bankers are immune from prosecution. And in this respect, and I think this is really important to understand, public respect for the rule of law and democracy is fading fast. Now, on the banking regulation side, some minor changes have been implemented, but everyone knows that the level of household debt in the real economy is just totally unsustainable in most countries. And especially if interest rates are to rise in the near future, the risks of major systemic failure are as high now as they were in 2007, possibly even higher. But it gets worse. As the banking crisis spread into the real economy, neoliberal politicians reacted by imposing austerity measures just at the wrong time, which largely hit the poorest of the poor households and the poorest regions in countries and regions across Europe and the rest of the world, with the result that many economies have been in prolonged recession, poverty and inequality has worsened massively, and the crisis, as we all know, has spread into a full-blown political crisis. So if you join the dots between Lehman in 2008 and where we are 10 years later, you can see a full crisis of financial capitalism has led directly and is directly responsible for Brexit in Britain, for Donald Trump's election, and the rise of the radical right-wing governments and fascism in many parts of Europe and North America.
OK, and on the one hand, we're seeing more of the same with wealth extraction rather than wealth creation, and the situation does look dark politically. But the flip side of that is that we have made quite a lot of progress, and a lot of that was kind of helped by the financial crisis from the point of view that there's been a lot of pressure coming from the people, from civil society, public anger towards politicians and big international organisations to actually do something. So we've had progress, not perfect, but important steps forward internationally, emerging global standards, things like country by country reporting for multinational companies, automatic information exchange agreements between countries, public registers of the real owners of companies. And there are some moves, we think, towards the idea of unitary taxation, which taxes companies based on the actual substance of their business more fairly. Not perfect, but that is what happens when the pressure comes from below, and we need to keep going with that.
There's definitely a better public understanding that financial crime and tax evasion are widespread, and they are caused by the failure in rulemaking. What are the next steps then for the tax justice movement? Because there's a real need to, this time, before the next crash comes, to have a really good, proper set of solutions very clearly fixed in people's minds, because the solutions are there.
Yeah, the solutions are there, and we need to anticipate that when the crash comes, and we all think it's going to come, possibly within the next 24 months, that politicians will need to hear from us, from civil society, this is what we're demanding. Now, I think that the tax justice movement globally needs to move forward in a number of directions. Here's my three top lines of attack.
Oh, good.
So, first, we need to shift tax regimes towards taxing wealth. We know that wealth inequality has become mad. We need to tax wealth rather than income. And in practical terms, that means land value taxes, cutting away all the exemptions around the capital gains tax regimes, removing all those vast numbers of tax reliefs available to industries like property development, for example, full-blown wealth taxes, and alongside that, a stronger corporate tax regime with significantly higher rates and virtually no tax reliefs made available to the big companies. Secondly, we have to address this, all the issues that are thrown up by this phenomenon called the finance curse. When a financial sector becomes too large, it moves from supporting wealth creation and it becomes a wealth extraction sector. It extracts wealth from the rest of the economy. Now, we can see this in many countries, perhaps most strikingly in the UK, where the City of London extracts huge sums from the rest of the economy. Now, tighter regulation and higher taxes, for example, a financial transaction tax, would reduce, if not eliminate, some of this economic blight. Next, I think we really have to address the whole role of the enablers. Not only have bankers and accountants and lawyers abandoned professional ethics in favour of profit maximisation, it should be clear to everyone by now that their business models are geared towards supporting tax avoidance, engaging in wealth extraction, assisting white-collar crime, and undermining democracy. So we have to focus on the professions. Ideally, we need to break up the big four accounting monopolies, which means in practice separating audit functions from all kinds of other consulting services, including tax services. And if necessary, we need to push for the creation of state auditors to strengthen multinational audits. Now, as far as the banks are concerned, much tougher treatment is needed to enforce cooperation on tackling tax evasion. And we must never again allow big global players of banks like HSBC, for example, to engage in money laundering without losing their license to operate. And 10 years after Lehman, the banking stables are as filthy as ever. The tax havens are still in business. Western liberal democracy is showing all the signs of cracking under the pressure. But I think it's civil society now that has to kind of fill that vacuum and come forward with the specific policy measures that needed ahead of the next crisis and after the next crisis.
Yes, and we're going to talk about this next month in the TaxCast in edition 82 with Nick Shackson, whose new book, The Finance Curse, How Global Finance is Making Us All Poorer, and there's going to be a lot of ideas about that to come.
Yeah, now we need to win the arguments against the two big banks and the two big financial services sector and make the case that hosting a big financial services sector is not necessarily good for your national economy, let alone for the rest of the world.
And it's a national and international security threat as well. We'll talk about that next month.
More of that later.
Right, so another thing we talked about on the TaxCast is the rise of plutocracy, rule by the rich for the rich, government by the wealthy. And we've seen, you know, for example, as a manifestation of all this, two huge tax-dodging companies hit $1 trillion in value this month, Apple and Amazon, or Scamazon, as I like to call them. And now, looking at the US government, which is full of extremely wealthy people who have been cutting away at all sorts of taxes, not for the little people, of course.
Sure.
Now, we've seen five of Trump's close advisors have been convicted of or admitted crimes. The former Trump campaign manager, Paul Manafort, has this month pleaded guilty to some lesser charges since he was facing a prospect of life in prison. He's sorted out a plea deal with prosecutors on charges relating to money laundering and undisclosed foreign lobbying. And all that means that he has to now sing like a canary. So that's going to be interesting. Now, he had deep ties to Russian and Ukrainian oligarchs. And apparently he built up a $65 million in foreign bank accounts just over a four-year period, which is really astonishing. Just by the by, he's a big fan of ostrich leather jackets. So an interesting development that tells us a lot about the Trump administration.
Yeah, and I think you're right to, you didn't use the word oligarchy to say that essentially the Trump government isn't a government of oligarchs. Finally, and this seems to have dragged on for endless months, Paul Manafort, who was campaign manager for Donald Trump, also a lawyer, is now a convict. Well, he was also a lawyer who abused the trial process. You might remember in June, he was sent to jail for attempting to tamper with the entire trial process by using encrypted telephone messaging to try to interfere with potential witnesses at his trial. So they sent him to jail. So this is a lawyer who is now being found guilty of the following crimes. First, guilty on five counts of tax fraud, guilty on two counts of banking fraud, guilty on one count of failing to disclose a foreign bank account, plus a further 10 counts of charges where the jury was unable to reach a consensus. 18 counts, I think, in total, 18 charges, quite extraordinary. So quite clearly, the president's former campaign manager was not a man who paid much attention to Abraham Lincoln's plea that US citizens should be of sound morality with a reverence for the Constitution and the law. Manafort, as you say, has connections throughout Eastern Europe, Ukraine, Russia. Much of his fortune appears to stem from those connections. And by and large, he seems to have been a mover and shaker. I mean, he's not actually doing business. He's selling influence. what emerges from Manafort's indictment and the subsequent trial is that this is the man who is intimately bound up in the world of offshore finance. In his indictment, Manafort, along with his business partner, a certain guy called Richard Gates, was accused of laundering $75 million US dollars through multiple bank accounts and shell companies set up in Cyprus, that's in the Mediterranean, Seychelles in the Indian Ocean, and St. Vincent and Grenadines, which is in the Caribbean. The real problem, I think, revealed by the Manafort trial is that he represents an entire class of what you might call offshore guys living in an offshore world. They think nothing of breaking laws and cheating societies. They have complete contempt for democracy. Now, whilst Manafort will spend the foreseeable future sitting in a prison cell thinking about his useless life, the problem is that far too many of the other perpetrators, in other words, that vast army of offshore lawyers, accountants and their clients, won't be joining him there in the prison.
Thanks, John. John Christensen from the Tax Justice Network. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. TaxCast listeners know that rules and laws aren't meant for everyone to follow. They're just for the little people. This month on the TaxCast, I'm speaking to journalist and corruption sleuth Oliver Bullough, whose latest book is just out. And the title says it all, really. It's called Moneyland: Why Thieves and Crooks Now Rule the World and How to Take It Back. Let's start with what Moneyland actually means to you. Let's start there.
So Moneyland is an idea that came to me in Ukraine after the revolution in Ukraine, when there was this effort to track down the stolen assets of the former ruling elite. And the assets were gone, they'd vanished. And there were a lot of journalists like me sort of looking for them, trying to find out what kind of tricks they'd used, what sort of offshore structures they'd used. And it occurred to me that all of these assets that had been stolen weren't anywhere. They weren't in Britain, they weren't in Monaco, they weren't in Switzerland or Ukraine. They were somewhere else that didn't actually exist. And so the more I thought about it, the more helpful I found it as a concept and the more sort of interesting a way of looking at the world, that essentially, if you're rich and your money is held in multiple jurisdictions and your life is in multiple jurisdictions, you're essentially able to pick and choose which laws you obey. You can say, well, you know, for taxation purposes, I'm going to obey the laws of Switzerland. For privacy purposes, I'm going to obey the laws of Nevis. For, you know, for education purposes, I think maybe the UK. For political lobbying purposes, the US. And it gets to the point when you no longer live in one country or have anything to do with one country. You've got a bespoke country of your own. And this is what I call Moneyland, trying to explain how the transnational elite that are running so many countries has essentially broken free of any kind of democratic control.
And we're increasingly seeing plutocracy rule by the rich for the rich, from Russia to the United States, with levels of greed you write about in the book that you just can't believe sometimes.
It's absolutely extraordinary, but that's just how the Moneyland system works. As long as one jurisdiction is prepared to rent out its structures and its legal system to wealthy people, then that's how the world works. Money is international. Money flows seamlessly around the world. Laws don't. And therefore, there will always be mismatches. And where there are mismatches, there are loopholes. And where there are loopholes, wealthy people and powerful people can take advantage. I spent quite a lot of time in St. Kitts and Nevis. Nevis is a particularly egregious tax haven that has been essentially created and crafted deliberately by American lawyers in order to allow their clients to dodge American law. And, you know, they have this approach whereby American lawyers write laws for them. They sort of groups of American lawyers, workshop the laws, pick and choose from all the different states of the union to create kind of super laws, which are kind of genetically engineered laws, which are so powerful that they combine the best aspects of Delaware and Wyoming and Nevada and South Dakota. And then they unleash them back on America. And they're extraordinary what you can do with them. And to be honest, Nevis is significantly better regulated. I mean, it's a swamp by any normal standards, but compared to Nevada, it's Sweden.
Right, and this market is not going anywhere anytime soon, right? Because, I mean, you're talking about the scale of the high net worth individuals and how that's projected to rise to $35.7 trillion. With an additional $8.7 trillion of newly created wealth over the next 5 years. And if that's true, then they'll have added the equivalent of the GDPs of Japan and Germany to their stock of wealth in half a decade. I mean, that's staggering. That's a huge amount of money washing around.
Yeah, I mean, it's massive. And what's interesting about this was this moneyed class, this sort of 1% that is dominating and 0.1% that is taking greater and greater proportion of the planet's wealth, is how this whole class of enablers is now being grown up to serve only their needs. And there's this very interesting sort of financial markets theory called plutonomy, which was created by a couple of very perceptive analysts from Citibank in the mid-2000s. And their idea was basically, now there are so many companies that serve only the needs of the 0.1% that essentially they're entirely divorced from the rest of the economy. And it doesn't really matter what happens in the rest of the economy. So, say for someone like Burberry, you know, they just do fine whatever happens. You know, Patek Philippe, they don't need to worry about what the oil price is because people who buy them don't worry what the oil price is. And so essentially, if you invest your money in the shares of these companies, then you're going to gain a disproportionate return on the stock exchange and make more money, which you can then spend on these products, which you can then invest back. And it goes on and on in this sort of vicious circle. And it's totally changing how economies work. It does actually explain what's wrong with the world, why inequality is growing so much, you know, why politics in so many countries simultaneously, whether that's Turkey or Hungary or Poland or the United States or Britain, why politics is increasingly dominated by this very tight elite class. It's all about Moneyland.
Yes, and there is such disgusting examples of corruption in some places like Ukraine. And yet the enablers are in London, in Geneva, New York. And this is very useful for people like Putin to kind of use that against these countries by saying, oh, well, you know, they're no better than us.
We have a fundamentally wrong conception of what corruption is. Corruption has always existed. As long as there's been anyone with power, inevitably it will exist. But it was always confined to a place. Essentially, the corrupt person lived among his or her victims because you couldn't carry the money away with you. The money was, you know, physical wealth of some kind. The creation of the international financial system, and particularly the creation of the offshore financial system, which I get into in the book, basically divorced wealth from place. Wealth was suddenly in the cloud. It was anywhere and nowhere. And that takes off the limits of how much you can steal, because if you don't have to carry the money around with you, you can just keep stealing. And because of the connections offshore, you could then zip the money through the offshore system and it ends up in London where it couldn't be taken away from you. So I came up with this formulation: you steal it, you hide it, you spend it. And it's these three phases that are the heart of Moneyland, because previously you could steal stuff and spend it, but you could see the connection between them, or you could steal stuff and hide it. But if you hid it, then you couldn't do anything with it. It was the fact that Moneyland and the offshore system gave you this: you steal it, you hide it and spend it, and everything is dynamic. And that is what allowed corruption to be unleashed. But we still think of corruption in national terms. You know, if you look at the Transparency International Corruption Perceptions Index, countries are ranked by country. You know, I think New Zealand at the top and South Sudan or wherever it is at the bottom at the moment. But actually, kleptocracy, which is what the problem is now, is transnational by its nature. It always involves three jurisdictions as a minimum. And so it doesn't really make any sense to talk about London being clean or Britain being clean and Nigeria being dirty, because it's all part of the same system. And it's particularly vexing when you see someone like New Zealand being sort of top of the list, because New Zealand is, you know, the shell companies in New Zealand are about as bad as it gets, to be honest. They're almost as bad as what's happening in somewhere like Nevis. And yet, you know, because New Zealand is somewhere where you don't pay a bribe, you know, to a New Zealand official, it's not listed as corrupt. And actually, I think there's an element of colonial thinking still left in the way that we think of corruption. We think of it as something that happens over there. It's not a problem that affects us. But actually, it's because of these, got these three phases: stealing it, hiding it and spending it. We're only talking about the stealing of it part. But actually, the second two parts are equally important. If you couldn't hide it, you wouldn't steal it. And if you couldn't spend it, you wouldn't steal it. So we need to start thinking about this as a transnational network and not just as a nationally bounded problem.
Absolutely, couldn't agree more. And it's interesting if we look at the idea of contagion, yeah. And that goes in many directions. You know, I'm thinking about how you look at the United States today and the associates of Donald Trump who have their very strong links with Ukraine and with Russia, with possible interference in the electoral process there. Brexit, with unknown donations, went into the referendum, which eventually resulted in a vote to leave. The tentacles of this type of thinking about I can buy whatever I want because they can, where that's leading to. It's a very dangerous place.
I mean, it's, you know, if you look at this World Bank's type estimates, they say about a trillion dollars is stolen every year from developing countries and stashed offshore and ultimately spent in wealthy countries. You know, $1 trillion is a huge amount of money. You know, if you had $1 trillion, it would take you 34,000 years to count them. It's a really ridiculous amount of money. And all of that money is owned by thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of different people from all over the world, all with different interests and different purchasing habits and all that. But they all have one overriding interest, which they share, which is they don't want to have their money exposed, because if it's exposed, it will be taken away from them. This is illegally acquired money. So any sort of political movement that would threaten to take that money away from them is inevitably going to be opposed by them. So you end up with this sort of wars of money that act against attempts to act transnationally against this transnational corruption. And I think this is certainly the way to see, say, Russia's determined opposition to the EU, for example. The EU has transnationally successfully created these, you know, anti-money laundering directives, which have been good and have brought up the standards in the EU countries from very, very poor to, okay, they're not great everywhere, but they're a lot better than they used to be. And we're acting together against this sort of transnational money. And it seems to me, certainly, that this kind of donations that went into funding the Brexit campaign from this unknown donors and still unknown donors, that's the best way to interpret them. These are people who really don't want the EU to succeed, because the EU is an organisation that was threatening to make it very difficult to stash stolen money here. I think also you probably can look at the interference in the American election in the same way. Anything that derails international or concerted action against dark money is a threat to the owners of dark money, and they will act together, even if they don't know each other. They will act together because they have a common interest in preventing this from happening, which is essentially another way of saying that dark money is the enemy of democracy, that there is a battle between money and democracy, and right now money is winning. And it's a very worrying thought that we aren't more aware of this as a society, and we really need to think about it, because, you know, $1 trillion a year is a lot of money, and that is being stolen every year, which means all of that money is stacked up against us, and the longer we don't act, the more money there will be essentially fighting back, and it's been fighting back very successfully.
And you make the point as well that Manafort was a Trump associate, was using such similar processes as the Ukrainian politicians who stole all the money that they did. You know, exactly the same kind of pattern, same trajectory. It's interesting.
I mean, it's really interesting. I mean, actually, an article which I did since the book came out about the misuse of limited liability partnerships in the UK, which are owned offshore, I think, into Nevis and in other places, but are used as sort of secrecy vehicles. Manafort was using them in exactly the same way as Russian money laundering rings were using them, and Ukrainian oligarchs were using them, all for the same purposes, because they were disguising their identities and allowing them to move money around without being uncovered. But Manafort's not Ukrainian. He had the opportunity, and he took the opportunity, and that's what it is. Corruption is a crime of opportunity. And that's the thing, it's the thing about corruption. If you can steal stuff, you do. But it's not just a question of stealing stuff because you can. There's also an element of the system becoming compulsive. I had a friend in Ukraine who's a lawyer who was explaining it to me when I just started researching this. And he explained it to me by saying, look, you've really got to understand it's not a matter of a choice between taking a bribe and not taking a bribe. The choice is between taking a bribe and having your children killed. Of course you take the bribe. You know, that really puts things into perspective, because if you're an honest person and you're going to sit there being honest and doing your job well and honestly, you are a threat to the whole system and you need to be got rid of. So it becomes a self-perpetuating system. It becomes the corruption, becomes the whole system. In fact, I quote in the book, an SBU, which is the Ukrainian version of the KGB, the successor to the KGB, he actually says, look, if you think of Ukraine as corrupt, you're misunderstanding Ukraine, because corruption is a problem when it's a disease that afflicts a healthy system. It's maybe 10% of it, 15% is corrupt, like a mafia clan in New York. It's corruption is the bit that's diseased on a healthy system. In Ukraine, everything is corrupt. So it's not, you can't think of it as corrupt anymore, because you're thinking about it in the wrong way. The mafia and the state have become fused. We don't have words really to describe that. In the West, we don't have the concepts, and we really need to develop them.
That's true, but it's coming our way. It's coming our way. I was wanting to ask you quite an interesting example of how the rich can just stop the truth coming out. You know, just thinking you were writing about this, the story that you couldn't publish, you spent all this time on a very good story, which you in the end couldn't publish. I think it's a good example of what sort of thing we're dealing with.
I have to be careful talking about this story because I wrote the chapter very carefully and I went through and rewrote it to remove any identifying characteristics to make it impossible for anyone to tell who it is I'm writing about. I didn't identify the country they came from, any aspects of them. But essentially, I discovered a very wealthy, well-connected gentleman from a former Soviet country who had made an absolute killing it was illegal, but I mean, obviously, them not having ever been convicted of a crime. But what was amazing is they had sort of offshored their children to Europe. And these children were living here in this sort of Eurotrashy kind of a way and were, you know, trying to have these kind of cultured, sort of sophisticated lifestyles, and essentially hired a load of really famous, like household name, you know, cultural figures to essentially kind of hang out with them and be their kind of friends. And for me, it was like the perfect story because it was steal it, hide it, spend it all in one story, because I could see where the money came from. I could see, because of a couple of leaks and a bit of research I did in various places, how it was being hidden. I got all the shell companies, got all the documentation, everything I had. And then I could see where it was being spent because, you know, these people live on Instagram. You could just see it all happening. And it was absolutely all there. And then I wrote this article, which I was very proud of, actually. It was years of work. And then and the lawyers said, I'm sorry, we can't do this. You know, this is British libel law, the insanity of British libel law, that it would be deemed defamatory to be connected to your own father when you're spending your father's money. It's like, it wasn't me that made the connection. The connection was made by them when they were spending his money. But that was the thing. And it makes it very, very hard to publish anything. I mean, and this isn't just something that's afflicted me. It's a sort of very disturbing story with Cambridge University Press when they had Karen Deweisha's book, Putin's Kleptocracy. I mean, I think they'd published, five, six of her books before. She was an established on their roster, one of their authors. And they said, I'm sorry, we really like the book. It's very good. We have no complaints with its content or the way you've written it, but we cannot take the risk of publishing this book. The risk of being sued is more than we can take.
Right, and just to explain, in that book, she'd been writing about all her research into Putin and his links to organised crime.
Yeah, I mean, the darkest kinds of organised crime, you know, cocaine smuggling out of St. Petersburg, like the mob in Spain, like really thorough, detailed, incredibly well-researched book, you know, which was then published subsequently in the United States, where the law's a bit different. But this chilling effect of the British libel law stretches way beyond Britain. I have a friend in Angola called Raphael, who is Angola's sort of independent media scene. He's incredibly brave, you know, and a brilliant journalist. And he got sort of a letter from a UK libel specialist basically saying, you know, stop this or we'll come after you. And he says, well, go for it. I don't have anything for you to take. I work in my kitchen. Good luck. And so they wrote to all the publications that published him, which weren't in the UK. These are English language publications in various African countries. And they all dropped him because they couldn't take the risk. And that's it. That is now, how do you get information out of Angola now? You know, and this is, you know, wealthy Angolans, the daughter of the former president owns a big property empire in West London. This is like, these people are here and yet you can't read about them because of British libel law. And this is another part of it. That's another aspect of Moneyland. There's a loophole there. British libel law is very generous to the wealthy complainant. So you take advantage of the loophole and you shut down debate, and therefore you get to close channels of information. And that's not just a question of the reading public not being able to read what that's about, but journalist articles become, you know, they start legal investigations. They become, this is where police get their ideas from. You know, this is where due diligence companies get their information from when they're approving who's going to get a passport or not. It's really important raw material for the way the rest of the system works. And if you can shut that down, then wealthy people get away without being investigated in ways that they should.
And this is the whole thing about contagion, right? I mean, the race between nations on crappy legislation and secrecy, and the fact that the United States, the United Kingdom and some others are unashamedly trying to outdo each other to conquer the dirty money market. The UK's always been of concern, but Tax Justice Network's latest financial secrecy index names the United States the jurisdiction of most concern for them.
One of the most disquieting things I wrote about in the book, and if you look at the increase in assets held in trust in South Dakota since 2008-09, that sort of post-financial crash period, South Dakota, which releases these figures, the other big trust states in the US don't, in trust in South Dakota has risen from $40 billion to $250 billion in, 9 years. You know, that is a growth rate that I mean, anyone would give their right hand for. And that's just one state with one trust system. On top of that, you've got Wyoming, Nevada is massive, Delaware obviously is massive. You know, all of these places are just sucking this money in because, as actually a Nevadan state congressman explained to me, he said, who would put their money in Cyprus now where it's at risk from the US, you know, Department of Justice? You're not at risk here. I mean, the United States is very good in some ways to give them their due. I mean, you know, the FBI is very good at investigating this. The Foreign Corrupt Practices Act is very important as a lever for doing this. But internally, domestically, there's just this isn't happening. They're very good at projecting power beyond and projecting anti-corruption message overseas. But within America, they're really bad at it. Inequality is booming in the most remarkable way. I mean, every year, I mean, I think, was it 2 years ago, 62 people had the same amount of wealth as the bottom half of the world's population. This year it was 42 people. I suppose next year it will be even fewer. And this is totally skewing how democracy works and how politics works.
I've been talking to journalist Oliver Bullough about his new book, Moneyland, out this month and published by Profile Books. It's a real page-turner. That's it for now. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next month.